Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Monday, April 18th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. You can simple PDF file, click on the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, some of which contain shows where people have been stepped through the worksheet process, and some of them are comments and testimonials, and some are very useful questions about how a process that is so seemingly simple can be so powerful and effective. And it's been my experience that the more I listen back to those archives, the more insights I get on how to do this process. So that can actually be used as a tutorial for you if you're not able to call in live on the internet show or have a support group in your own area. That's part of why this show exists, to provide support to people who don't necessarily have a support group in their hometown, who don't really feel the need or the ability to set up their own support group. You can still learn. You can actually move into mastery with the use of these tools by listening over and over again to the shows in the archive that have been curated out from the last 11-plus years of internet shows 5 days a week. The first 8 years, it was 1 hour a day, and the last 3+ years, it's been 2 hours a day. And that archive is another free resource. If you go to whyagain.org, whyagain.org, and click on the image of the microphone, it will take you to a page where you can get access to the entire archives of the past 11-plus years of these internet shows. And if you're not able to access the show live, if you have comments or questions or testimonials or something you'd like to discuss, you can call us directly at 563-999-3581 and press 1 on your phone, and that will let me know you want to talk. I'll turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. And if you're not able to do that, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. And we hope people do that soon and often, because it's been our experience that will improve the quality of your life if you tap into these tools and start using them. And it also gives us good feedback about what we're doing that is of use and how we might be of service. So we appreciate when people call and let us know what their comments and questions. This year we've been working through the Way of Mastery. It's the began on January 10th. And the Way of Mastery has 3 books contained in the one volume. And in the way it was received originally, it was intended to remain as 3 separate books, but it now exists as a compilation. The 3 separate books are The Way of the Heart, The Way of Transformation, and The Way of Knowing. And they've been combined into the one book that's now known as The Way of Mastery. So we've been working through The Way of Mastery, reading each lesson at least twice with commentary since January 10th. And the access to those files, edited out to just the first hour of the Mind Shifters radio show, is available on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And the MindShiftersAcademy.org website began about 3 years ago. And I should probably say in 2019. And it's just another way to try and improve the exposure, expand the exposure to these tools and awareness of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice's work and their website at whyagain.org. And so what I've attempted to do there is make some of the files that we've created since beginning the second hour of Mind Shifters radio show available in a more direct format. And so we have interviews there with people like Pierre Pratervan and Dale Allen Hoffman and Guy Finley and Corinne Zupko and a bunch of others. And we have some audio files that have been selected out as highlight shows from our time doing Mind Shifters Radio. We also have information on there about how to join the 2 support groups that we run on Tuesdays and Thursdays, 6:30 p.m. till 9 Central Time. And ever since the coronavirus restrictions hit, we've been doing them online and free of charge. So you can donate if you wish, but there's no requirement for payment. And all you have to do is have internet access and join us through Zoom. Today, I thought we would go on into Lesson 9, Lesson 9 of The Way of Mastery. We just finished on Friday the second time through Lesson 8. And Lesson 9 is titled, All Events Are Neutral. And the text reads, I am your brother and your friend who looks upon you and sees naught but the face of Christ within you. The only thing I see when I look at you is the face of Christ. Your Creator looks at you and sees an infinite, perfect creation. Other entities who have had consciousness or been in the body, if they've dropped the body and they've done enough work, they see you as perfect, just the way you are. The capacity to see and experience yourself as this perfect energy of creation expressing in form is your birthright. It's not what you were trained into. It's not what you will get if you use your intellect and just the input of your five senses. It's not the assessment that you will make of yourself if you're stuck in your family of origin and your cultural conditioning, and yet it remains your truth. And so right here in the beginning of this lesson, they repeat what they've talked about in every lesson, which is the truth that is true always, which is you are the extension of the creative energy in form. You're infinite and eternal. You've never been born. You'll never face death. What is true about you is true about you always. And the sooner you tap into that awareness of that and practice staying focused on that truth moment to moment, the better your life will be. The less time you'll spend in the games of the culture and the trauma and the drama and the intellectual mind and all the trivialities that are poured into it. And the more you'll have the joy, the bliss, the aliveness that is your birthright that so many of these spiritual traditions talk about. So right here in the beginning of the ninth lesson, it says, I, and this is, you know, purportedly the consciousness of Yeshua coming through a human from 1994 to 97, and it says, I am your brother and your friend. And when I look upon you, all I see is your true nature. I see the shimmering radiance of the creative energy. I see the face of the Christ in you. Text goes on and says, Christ is the firstborn of creation. That is, that which is begotten and not made. Christ is the Creator's creation. Christ is the holy child of creation. Christ is to the Creator as a sunbeam is to the sun, radiating forever from the holy mind of all creation. Of what I have called Abba, Father, Father, Mother, God, source of all. Therefore, it says, I come to abide with you in perfect joy and in perfect freedom and in perfect reality, actuality. I come forth to join with that part of you that abides always in perfect knowledge, perfect peace, perfect knowingness, and in perfect union with your Creator. I come not to speak of things you do not know. I come not to use words that do not already abide within you. I come not with wisdom that you do not already contain. I come not with a love grander than that which already flows in the silent places of your own heart. I come not to place myself above you. I come only to walk as an equal beside you. So this paragraph is about the essence of this work from the first lesson on. The first lesson says right up front in the fifth page, this idea of awakening begins if you start to let the idea into your mind that nothing you experience is caused by anything outside of you, that you experience only the effects of your own choice. You are a creator. You have access to all of the wisdom, all of the strength, all of the power of creation that any other human being has ever had. All of the great minds, all of the gurus, all of the saints, all of the ascended masters, whatever phrase you want to use, you have access to that same source of intelligence, of guidance, of wisdom, of intuition. And Yeshua is saying here in Lesson 9, I come because I have great love for you. I come because I'm your friend. I'm not greater than you. I'm not wiser than you. I'm not more valuable than you. I come to walk as an equal beside you. I come to reintroduce you, to help you remember what is true about you always. The fourth paragraph on this page says, I come because I love you. I come because I'm your friend. Of all the things that I could possibly choose to do with the unlimited power of consciousness that's been given equally unto me of the Father as it has been given unto you, and of all the places and dimensions and worlds in which I could abide in this moment, I come to abide with you in this work, in this moment. Why would I do that? I come to bridge the gap that seems to yet separate you from me. The point of this teaching is to wake us up to the fact that we are a part of the Christ mind. When it says birthing the Christ mind in the previous chapter in one of the headings, it meant to awaken to the truth that there is access to the Christ mind in each and every one of us. It's not creating the Christ mind. It's turning our conscious awareness to what is already there, what has always been there, and will always be there. This is something, again, that the conscious logical mind cannot grasp. This is something that the intellectual mind will want to argue against. And the intellectual mind, as this book points out, is what Michael Rice calls the 9-bit mind, the carbon-based memory. This is just like a hard drive in a computer, and all the hard drive in a computer can do is record what's played into it and play it back when it's requested. The hard drive in a computer has no intelligence. The operating system, the person who programmed it, there's intelligence that taps into this high-level record and playback device that we call a hard drive. That's essentially what's happening with the brain in our head. And what this teaching points out in the previous lessons is our intellect was never meant to be our master. It was meant to be a very simple tool, just like the hard drive in a computer doesn't run the whole computer. The computer of itself does nothing, but an intelligence outside the computer uses the computer as a tool. That's what the carbon-based memory, that's what the brain in your head, that's what the intellectual thought patterns are intended to do for you, is to be a tool that you, some consciousness outside of your thoughts about yourself, some consciousness uses the intellect at very specific times for very limited purposes, and when that purpose is achieved, that consciousness puts the tool down and moves on. The next paragraph reads, in reality, all dimensions of creation reside in a space far smaller than the tip of a pin. In reality, all dimensions of creation are so vast that you could never measure them. So this is another koan. This is another seemingly conflicting series of statements. Why? Because we need to demonstrate to the conscious logical mind that it cannot comprehend all of the energies, all of the experience of life, all of the levels of dimension which have as much reality as your physical body, and they're simply not registered by your five senses. And that's why it says, right in the first lesson, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. It's the way of the awakened heart. It's the pathway that comes from learning to tune into energies and insights and connections and wisdom and expansion of this flow of creative energy that your conscious, logical mind can't even begin to comprehend. And any part of your mind that says, oh, I get it, when it says, in reality, all dimensions of creation reside in a space far smaller than the tip of a pin, and yet in reality all dimensions of creation are so vast you could never fully measure them. Oh, I get it. I know what that means. That part of your mind is lying to you so that it can seem to have control. And one of the things that this teaching really very, very gently but methodically and consistently brings up is the idea of needing to be divinely ignorant, needing to wake up to the realization that I don't know what anything is or is for. Learning to do what Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, would say we must do is learn to live in the questioning state without demanding answers. Because in the moment when we ask a really good question, the mind that asked that question isn't even capable of comprehending the answer. That mind must grow and expand and have experiences. And expand in ways that it can't even imagine before it can comprehend the answer to a really good question. So when your mind says, oh yes, this makes very good sense, have a good chuckle at it. Be playful. And just say, oh, look at that. Here's a mind. Here's my mind that wants to say it's smarter than the average bear and it knows what this means. We have no idea what this means. We have no idea how the next sentence could be true when it says, in reality, there's no gap between where you are and where I am. Well, how could that be? I'm here. I'm in my empty office. I see, you know, the wall unit across from me and the computer on the desk, and there's no other person here. How could Yeshua be here? The conscious logical mind cannot comprehend it. And when it tells you it knows, it doesn't know. This is why so many of the ancient Eastern traditions say things like, he who knows, he who says he knows doesn't know. She who says she doesn't know, she's onto something. The text goes on to say, this is why I can be no further from you than the width of a thought. But, oh, beloved friends, the power of a thought is the power to create universes within universes and to create yet more universes within those universes, to create world upon world upon world upon world. That's the power of creation given unto you by your creator, because your mind energy is a creative force. And it's always on, as we've talked so often about in these lessons. You don't have the choice to turn it off. You can only choose where you point it. So this weekend I was with somebody at an energy center, and she was talking about all of the, how she knows, she studied Course in Miracles and she does all this energy work, and then she launched into an angry tirade about the medical community and about all of the restrictions and all of the pushing of drugs, and she was just filling with anger. Her mind in that moment, she's sitting in a beautiful office. Right? We're having a lovely conversation. And then her mind turns to angry thoughts. And the energy radiating off of her was practically palpable. She turned the focus of her thoughts to anger. And in the middle of this wonderful conversation about all the great work they do at their energy center and how much healing is taking place there, she shifted her focus over to anger. And she created for herself in that moment an experience of the world as a place of us against them and conflict and bitterness and hurt and resentment. And it was nothing more than the shifting of her thoughts. And it was lovely because I just took a breath, felt the energy, and reminded her that just a minute ago we were talking about, she said she'd studied the Course in Miracles. And I just, you know, pointed out how it talks about choosing between love and fear. And her response was to take a breath, and as she let it go, she thanked me for the reminder, and her energy shifted. And this is just the tiniest example of how our thought energy, our mind energy, as Michael Rice would call it, is the creative force. And here in this paragraph, in the fifth paragraph on page 106 in lesson 9, it says, that thought energy, that thought has the power to create universes. And many universes within many universes and world upon world upon world upon world upon world. And it's been happening in your life even though you have not been told that it's happening. Even though you've had it hidden from you, you've still been creating. And that's the good news and the bad news all wrapped up into one. The bad news is you're the one who's created all the misery in your life. The good news is if you choose to do something different, you can start creating something other than misery in your life. The next paragraph reads, your lived experience is that momentarily your attention seems to be focused on your unique world, which shares some things in common with many other beings. You have what is called in your world a consensus reality. We would say it's a consensus experience. Because this book and the people that are sending this message forth, they understand that we create our own experience. And that what we call reality, the way Dr. Michael Rice separates it out, is that each and every one of us has our own individual perception and reality inside our heads. And yet there is one actuality occurring. And so this book says, rather than a consensus reality, we would say you're having a consensus experience born out of a universal reality. That would be what Dr. Michael Rice calls a universal actuality. The text goes on and says, beloved friends, even as you abide in your awareness in this moment, you are the creator of the world you experience. And this is one of those sentences where if you truly understood everything in that sentence, you wouldn't need anything else in this book. If you truly understood how even as you abide in your awareness in this moment, you are the creator of the world you experience. Then, if you understood that and how it was happening, every time you began to have an experience that you didn't like, you would create differently. The text goes on to say, and you do this in so many ordinary ways. When you stand face to face with anyone for just a split second, you alter the position of your body through which you gaze upon them, you take up a new stance, a new perspective, and in that split second, you've created a new experience for yourself. When you look upon a friend and the mind moves from neutrality, which is where you begin every experience, this is a critical piece. So I'm going to read that again. This sentence says, you begin each new present moment absolutely neutral. Prior to thought arising, prior to judgment, prior to the perceptual, to the formation of a perception, you begin each moment neutral. When you look upon a friend and the mind moves from neutrality, which is where you begin every experience, into the thought, quote, well, this is my friend Mary. This is my friend Saint Germain. This is my friend Peter. This is my friend Joanna. This is my friend Nathaniel. Whatever the name might be, when you hold that thought, you already begin to change your experience. When you name something, when you label it, you call into your experience all of your previous associations. Then you begin living from the past. You start resonating images, memories, interactions, positive, neutral, negative, whatever they are, and you begin more of an interaction with the images and thoughts and associations inside your brain and your mind than you have connection to the person who's right in front of you. Whatever the name may be, when you hold that thought, already you begin to change the experience. You are a literal creator in that moment. For when you name anything, you define it according to the factors that you have built into the name that you use. When you look upon a field of energy arising from the mystery of Earth, and you say the word tree, instantly you have brought forth into your manifest experience everything you've ever decided is associated with the field of energy that you have called a tree. In this way, your experience is entirely unique. It's never been before and it will never be again. Nothing can repeat it. This is why creation is forever new. And when people start waking up to this, it leads to dramatically different experiences of life. There's a story of these two quite elderly Buddhist gentlemen sitting on a bench. And they've been there for hours, just sitting, just looking quietly. And all of a sudden, out of the silence, one of them erupts into laughter. And guffaw and knee slapping and tears streaming down his face. And his friend says to him, what's so funny? And the friend points out away from them across the little wooded park area they're in, points and says, they call that a tree. And the other one erupts in laughter and they laugh until there's no tears left to laugh. The absurdity of thinking that the conscious logical mind can know what a tree is in its entirety, in its flow of creative energy, in the animals that have used it as a home, in the people that have come and leaned against it or found shade in it, the interactions of these energy systems within energy systems within energy systems that our minds want to just crunch down into just a few little bits of information and past associations and put a label on it and say, oh, I know what that is. That's an oak tree. Oh, that's an elm tree. Oh, that's a maple. It is laughable how we create such a constricted experience in the midst of such endless creative flow. The text goes on to say, yes, you can stand with your friend and look upon a tree and nod your head and say, oh, of course, that's a tree. Oh, yes, I see the branches, I see the leaves. But as soon as you've named it, you've brought forth all of the associations you've called to yourself and your experience of that field of energy that you've ever called a tree. And rest assured, everybody else who looks at that tree sees, feels, experiences something differently. How could that be? Well, Think about those people who identify themselves as environmentalists, and they're here to protect the trees, and they're here to make sure that nobody ever cuts down a tree. And then there are those people who see the tree as a commodity, and they're loggers, or they work in the lumber industry, and they look at the tree and they see, wow, look what the furniture I could make out of that. They definitely see a different experience, though they both use the same word, tree. So which one's right and which one is wrong? That idea does not apply. Judging right or wrong only causes constriction, contraction, pain, suffering. The text goes on and says, in this lesson, we want to address another of the important pebbles that you must drop into the clear, still pool of your awareness. And it is simply this. All webs of relationship, all energy fields are absolutely neutral. What creates experience is how you decide you will view that web of relationship, that field of energy. The effect of that decision is also completely neutral. The text says, but how can that be? For when a logger sees a tree and sees only the profit to be made, forests disappear. And when an environmentalist looks at a tree, the tree remains and the mighty owls and the birds have a place to make their home. Surely, are we not to perpetuate the same reality, the same experience that all human beings have had? Is there not loss when the forest disappears? Listen. Listen well. Listen carefully. All events are neutral. You are the one that places the value upon it. This is how one person views a tree and says its value comes from the fact that it's here and untouched and I can sit underneath it and it's a home for the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. And another person looks at it and says, well, its roots are growing and I think it might interfere with my sewer in about 20 years, so I'm going to cut it down because I don't want it, you know, getting too close to the house I'm going to build. And someone else looks at it and says, oh, my goodness, I can just see the statue I'm going to create from this carved totem pole that, and I'm going to cut that thing down as soon as I can and strip the bark off and let it dry for a year and then turn it into this beautiful creation. Each of those people place different value on the same energy field that we're calling a tree. The text goes on to say, now, does that mean that one should become cold-hearted, unconscious, and blind to their actions? Of course not. For part of awakening means to realize one's interconnection with the web of all relationships. It means awakening a reverence for the mystery that is life. And it also means to release judgment of another who would view the tree differently. For you see, the body that you have crystallized out of a field of infinite energy has but one purpose. That purpose is to be a communication device. Therefore, let your primary perception, your primary guiding light in your third dimensional experience be something like this. Here's a suggestion. What do I choose to communicate to the world with every gesture, with every breath, with every word spoken, and with every decision made? That's just a suggestion. But the fact of the matter is, every gesture, every breath, every word spoken, and every decision we make, you make, I make, is going to communicate to the other beings of brilliance and light around us what we value. It's just, that's the way it is. That's just like having gravity on the planet. That's just like the fact that your mind energy is always on and always creating. That can't be changed. The next paragraph reads, "For ceaselessly, while the body lasts, you are engaged in the process of communicating to the world, making manifest to the world what you have chosen to value, what you have called into your experience and imbued with value." This means that ceaselessly, you are engaged in teaching the world what you believe holds the greatest truth and the greatest value. And this, I had this really brought to mind this weekend because, as I mentioned, I went to a place where they've dedicated their lives to healing and to energy techniques and acupuncture and inversion tables and sound therapy and biofeedback and ionic foot detox and scalar wave field energy and infrared sauna and Aspen laser therapy and pulse electromagnetic field therapy and frequency specific microcurrent. And they have cacao ceremonies, and they are as loving and as well-intentioned as anybody you'd ever want to meet. They've dedicated their lives to help improving the lives of others. And in the middle of the conversation about all of that loving, positive, healing stuff, a simple shift of thought over to, and there are these people that, and they're wrong, and they give meds, and they are trying to control us and take our freedoms, and just like that. Less than a heartbeat, the energy focus shifts, and all the love is gone. I was listening to the Pema Chodron book this morning, and she told the story of this one person who wanted to be enlightened, and he had a teacher, and his teacher said, you know, here's part of the pathway. And he says, okay, I got it. And he decides to go up and live in a cave. And he's up there, and he's practicing patience. And he's up there for years. And this very wise teacher finds him. Goes up there, finds, you know, he hears from the locals that this guy's up there. And he goes up there and he says, what are you doing up here? And the man in the cave says, I'm up here perfecting patience, perfecting the art of patience. And the elderly teacher goes up to him and gets right in his face, right just nose to nose, and says, yeah. And he taps him on the shoulder and says, yeah, but you know, old guys like us, we know that we only do that kind of stuff just to get people to think we're enlightened, right? And get people to give us reverence. I bet people bring you a lot of gifts and leave them outside your cave here. You know, you got quite a reputation in the local town down there. And the first guy who lives in the cave is starting to get a little uncomfortable and bristling, but the other guy doesn't let up. He keeps tapping him on the shoulder and says, oh, come on, admit it. You know, you're only doing this to try and get people to think how fabulous you are. And the next thing you know, the guy in the cave who thinks he's perfecting patience screams, get out of here. Leave me alone. Why are you ruining my peace? And the guy that came up to teach him a lesson said, oh, where's your perfect patience now? We, as long as we use the intellect, as long as we judge, as long as we decide we are not like everybody else, we're going to be special. We keep ourselves pulled out of the flow of life. We keep ourselves creating from the intellect, creating our personal experience from the intellect. And as this book pointed out in the third lesson, you know, the idea that you're creating something and manifesting something in your life, it's not new and it's not a secret. You're always creating with where you point your mind energy. The problem with this as a way of, you know, like the movie The Secret and all these people that create these schools where they're going to teach people how to manifest, the problem with that at its core is that as long as we stay stuck in the intellect, we can only manifest or learn to manifest what our culture or our family or our personal intellect has told us is what we should manifest. So we think we're out there being free when really we're only within the bounds of our culture and our language and our training. And, you know, Guy Finley has a wonderful talk where he says, you know, all this talk about manifesting this and manifesting that, and all these people have, they're puffing their chests up because they've got these fancy cars and they've manifested this great business and this flow of money through their website. And he says, I will give you something different to manifest, something that has actual value. You want to manifest something that's got actual value in your life? And the audience is bristling and says, yeah, yeah, tell us, tell us. And he goes, manifest a way to be happy in this moment with whatever you've already got. That the true happiness you're looking for, the peace that passes all understanding, has nothing to do with acquiring a single thing. And the reason it passes all understanding is because the intellectual, the conscious, logical mind can't understand why you're happy. If you're happy because you got the house, if you're happy because you got the relationship, if you're happy because you got the car, if you're happy because the bank account is overflowing, you're in trouble. Guy Finley says, because if you just step back and think about it, the minute you acquire the mansion or the car or the relationship and you think the acquisition of that thing is what brought you the good feelings, the happiness, the peace, the joy, the bliss, the next moment you're in fear about what if I lose it? What if my lover chooses to leave? What if the car breaks down or has an accident? What if there's a fire in the mansion? What if the stock market tanks and all my money goes? So every time we put judgment in place, and we see ourselves as different than the flow of creation, and we think that our satisfaction, our joy, comes from outside of us in relation to someone or something else, we create the very fear that we say we're trying to get rid of, we're trying to get away from. So what do you value? Abraham Hicks is fond of saying, look, you say you want the car, the house, the relationship, the finances, but what you really want is the feeling that you believe you're going to have once you acquire that thing. That what we're all going for in this realm of experience, and these lessons have already pointed this out, we live in a feeling. We live in an energy, an emotional state. So what we really want when we set out to acquire something is the feeling we think we're going to have once it's acquired. And so Abraham Hicks says, look, learn that you are the one who's creating your feeling in each moment. It's very much like this book. Learn the process of how you're creating your experience of life moment to moment with however you're choosing to focus your conscious awareness. And learn to create the positive feeling that you say that you believe you're going to have when the car comes in and when the relationship is going well, etc. Create that emotional state now. And then if you go out and acquire the car or the house, now you understand the emotional state, the peace, the experience of being connected to the flow of life in all creation is not dependent upon the direction of the wind or someone else's choices. And then you're free to enjoy, fully enjoy, the objects, the people, the relationship, the connection to all life through that experience of connection. You've stepped out of the dream of separation, and then all of the experiences of life are richer, fuller, deeper, broader than any words can describe. That last paragraph I read again says, "For ceaselessly, while the body lasts, you are in the process of communicating to the world, making manifest in the world what you have chosen to value, what you are calling into your experience, and what you are imbuing with value. This means that ceaselessly, constantly, you are engaged in teaching the world what you believe holds the greatest truth and the greatest value." So if you believe love is all there is and love heals all things, and then when you rage at how you think the medical profession or the government or this politician or that, what you're communicating in that moment is you don't really think love is the biggest, most powerful. You're speaking from a part of your mind that thinks anger is what should be valued here. Attack is what should be valued here. Judgment of separation is what should be valued here. This work is rigorous. This work is consistent, constant. You're constantly creating with what you choose to focus your mind energy on. And it was a wonderful example this weekend when I watched this woman's energy shift from this pride and this joy of describing her work and all of the great people she's met with it, and then flip into the anger and the judgment and the bitterness. And then flip back when I just pointed out to her, hey, just a minute ago you said you were studying A Course in Miracles and it talks about choosing love over fear. And she took a breath and softened and said, thanks for the reminder. That's the old habit of thought kicking in. That's the intellect that wants to drive the bus. And we have to be vigilant if we hope to learn a different way of how to experience the intellect as simply a tool rather than experiencing the intellect as who we are. But this lesson is here to tell us unequivocally, all events are neutral. That's the title of the lesson. And it says, whatever I choose to communicate to the world is going to get communicated with every gesture, every breath, every word spoken, and every decision made, whether I like it or not. Area code 760, you're in the air. Is this Ann?
Yes. Wow. So when you're going through the thing with the tree and stuff, I wrote a note, and then it just kind of comes full circle as you're ending this. So to a squirrel, a tree is not a tree. It's just a place to nest. Okay. So a child sees a tree, and they might call it something else as they're growing up. And then in our intellect, we're correcting them and say, oh, no, that's not whatever they called it. No, that's a tree. Or if they see a squirrel, and so often, like, you know, when I taught kindergarten, they have different names for things because they haven't been corrected maybe. So if they see a squirrel, they call it, you know, whatever they're calling it, and we correct them. Oh, no, that's a squirrel. How do we know that's a squirrel? So
we know only because we've been – remember that there is this tool. I to use the analogy of the hammer for the carpenter or the master carpenter who makes fine furniture. But
right.
the hammer is just one of a wide range of tools that that carpenter has at his or her disposal.
Right.
The
right.
intellect and our language and our labeling things is a useful tool in its place.
Okay.
We're not
yeah.
saying
okay.
It's,
okay.
that it's bad to label something as a tree. What we're saying with this teaching is understanding that that's just like having a hammer in your toolkit. It's not the only way we want to be able to experience life. The only way I want to relate to a piece of wood if I'm going to be a master carpenter is not that I have to just bang on it with a hammer and then be satisfied with whatever results I get. I want to have the planer and I want to have, you know, the etching tools and I want to have the finishing tools and I want to have the radial arm saw and the saber saw. I want all those things and I can use them where it's appropriate, the chisels, et cetera. And so my language and my labeling a tree as a tree is not a bad thing, but it has a very slight, limited application. And what this work is calling us to is to wake up to all of the other ways we can relate to the fields of energy that we interact with, whether they are people or squirrels or trees, etc. Does that make sense?
So, yeah. So instead of forcing, though, someone to see what you see as the way you see it, it's just like, oh, well, I see it from a different perspective. You know, when I grew up, I was taught this. Huh, you must have been taught something else, right? Rather than going, oh, no, it's got to be a tree. It's got to be this. It's got to be that. I mean, does that make sense what I just said?
Yes. Yes, it does. And that is one really good way to think about these approaches that we've been taught. And the approaches we've been taught are really all about judgment. Right?
Yes, yes.
Right,
yes.
Wrong, good, bad, etc. The labels. And that is not exhaustive, right? That's not the only way to see or experience things. And there's far more going on here than what my senses can tell me or what my language can describe.
Yeah.
So work like this is calling us to wake up, to start to live in the question, because there's so much more to experience than we've ever been introduced to, and that there is so much more to experience than our logic or our five senses can reveal to us.
Yes. I'll have to think about that, because I was trying to put this lesson to an incident that happened to me at church, and you know, I'm gonna go back and reflect. Okay, how much of that was I judging the people that jumped in and tried to fix something instead of going through the order of things? And I would have
all
learned
of
things
it.
That I work on the sound.
All of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
All
yeah.
of it. How much of it? All of it. And I would just, and we've only got, you know, like a minute left, but I would call
yeah.
your attention to the words you're using there when you say this incident that happened to me at church.
Right.
And I would
because
call
it was
your
my
attention
response.
To the fact
okay.
that nothing happened to you at church.
Yes. Thanks for the reminder. Yes, yes. Yes.
Isn't it funny? I wasn't even there, and I can say that with full certainty.
Right, right. And I can apply it.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you.
Thanks
thank
for the
you.
Call. Blessings. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tam. I'm enjoying your readings.
I'm glad to hear it. Have yourself a wonderful show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Monday, April the 18th, 2022, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and your questions, because that makes this your show. While we're waiting on Michael to dial in, as always, I will direct you to our website, which is www.whyagain.org. And I was trying to click on at the same time, and for some reason it's given me an issue here. But I will invite you to go to the website and look around. And if you find something that doesn't work or something you don't understand, please drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and let me know what the URL is, or let me know what your question is. You know, we can receive questions now directly from the app, and so we will answer them. Once I get an email, then I'll ask the question on the show, and we'll address it, and then I'll drop you back an email and let you know what day and time we addressed your question. Just another way to reach out and offer support. And we invite you to do that. We had a really awesome book club meeting, and that was on Thursday. And I haven't gotten the MP4 of it yet, but as soon as I get it, I'll have it on our website, and that will be under the, you can click on events or you can click on schedules, and you'll see it says Global Book Club. And all the information there, the Zoom link, how you can sign in, how you can join us. We're not going to have another meeting this month, but in May we will be doing the second and fourth Thursday, and from then on until we come to a completion of it. And who knows how long that's going to be. I think it's going to be questions and answers this next time that we meet, and that will be on the second Thursday, May the 12th. And then again on May the 26th. I was looking at my calendar there. And so please join us. It's an awesome group, awesome conversations. We did a worksheet with a lady this last time, and it was like a hydra. So it'll be awesome when we get that link from Yinka, and we'll put it on our website. And I think you'll enjoy listening to that and walking through the worksheet. The lady was super brave to put it all out there, and it took her into some deep places. And so we were all excited for her, and it gave us all a lesson. Welcome, Michael. Hello, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. You're here with us to continue this conversation, and it's fun to have the conversation expanding, especially over into Europe and India, and places elsewhere than here in America in the world. And the book club is accomplishing that, so that's kind of cool to see how that's happening. And, of course, the book is available in several different languages. If you want to go to the website, whyagain.org, you can download the book free and give it a read. And today I've kind of got my mind in the direction of how our culture has become so addicted to stuff. You know, people will do anything for more stuff. And looking into why that is, and I have an offering that is, I think, worth looking at, and is at least one of the reasons why people have become addicted to stuff. You know, Vladimir Lenin says, if you want to destroy a culture, all you have to do is change the meaning of its words. And it's interesting, there's a set of words in this culture that's repeated often that, and in fact, it's enshrined in the Constitution. And everybody thinks it's a great and wonderful thing, which, you know, it kind of is if you know the definition of the word. But if you don't know the definition of the word and you substitute it for what you're really looking for, then there's trouble. So there's a French paleontologist named Teilhard de Chardin. And Desjardins had an interesting definition, almost correct definition, for the word joy. He says that joy is the infallible sign of the presence of the Creator. Now, I'm just slightly in disagreement with him there, mostly in agreement, but slightly in disagreement, because if that were actually true, everybody would be in joy all the time, because nobody has ever been out of the presence of the Creator. So when we just add one word to it, joy is the infallible sign of the awareness of the presence of the Creator. When you're aware of who you are as love, when you live in the presence of and in the awareness of love, then you live in joy. You know, you think about the newborn child. What do people spontaneously call the newborn child? Oh, a bundle of joy. Notice they don't say a bundle of happiness. The founding fathers were pursuing happiness, and they put that in the cause, pursuit of happiness. They didn't say the pursuit of joy. But notice that when that pure state of being, that pure love comes into our lives, we spontaneously talk about it as the presence of joy, as the presence of love. And interestingly enough, that child is going to be brainwashed out of experiencing itself as what it is, as love, and therefore spontaneously live in joy, and it's going to be taught to go get more stuff. Now, I'd offer that when we define happiness properly, then we've got a big clue. Happiness is the result of achieving a goal. So if your goal is to get more stuff and you get stuff, you're happy. Oh, look, she got a new pack. She was really depressed. And then she looked out the door and there was a package there and she opened it and she had a new pair of whatever, a new hat, a new watch, whatever it was. And she was happy. Why was she happy? Because she had a goal for that stuff. And when the mind is set up so that when we achieve a goal, it gives us a shot of what's called happy powder, dopamine. It's actually the stuff that when, say, for instance, people use cocaine, why do people get, what's people get burned out on cocaine and become depressed? Because cocaine uses dopamine. It uses up the raw material of your happy powder. And so if you use all of that up and there's no dopamine left, you can snort as much coke as you want. And you have to snort more and more and more. And the more you snort, the more you use the dopamine up, the less dopamine you have, the less possibility is to get that high or that hit that is so thrilling, but short term and always involves a crash. So notice the girl that was depressed and went and saw the door package at her door and got it and was happy for a moment, was only happy for a moment till that dopamine hit was gone, and then she was back in her depression. Now, if you brought her more stuff, another gift that she was looking for, she might have been happy for a little while till the dopamine wore off. And so we've become a culture that's about stuff. The thing that kind of stimulated this conversation for me this morning, I had to come across, I was doing a search for something, and I came across a video. It was really quite interesting. I actually posted it on my Facebook page, and it was just all kinds of inventions. Like, I don't know, I didn't count them, but 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. I didn't actually watch the whole thing, but it might have been 30 different. And just amazing inventions. I mean, you know, the way they make turn a piece of round pipe into a steel, a square steel girder, or, you know, I mean, just really cool technology stuff, right down to how they package ice cream and the inventiveness of it. And what I realized is, with all of this that people are so happy about, it's all about stuff. if one is constantly pursuing stuff, kind of like dopamine or cocaine uses up dopamine, they use up their dopamine supplies, and then there's no boost, there's no juice left for happiness. Even all the stuff becomes boring because they've used up all of the raw materials of dopamine, and they become, you know, the billionaire commits suicide with all the stuff that you could possibly have. So my offering is that we need to be thinking about that, and if we're stuck in that pursuit, and it seems like we're successful, when I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, means I achieved the goal. And you can watch people achieving negative goals, destructive goals. You know, the kid who's a bully is happy when he beats another little kid up, because he has a goal. You know, he probably comes from a home where he was abused or she was abused, and being abused felt no power. And when they found somebody else they could beat up, the goal to have some power seemed to really be wonderful, and they were happy by beating someone else up. And having achieved that goal to have power, they get a hit of dopamine. But you'll notice people live in that world. You know, we can look in the political world and it becomes pretty obvious who's playing that game. There is no happiness once the dopamine's used up. And when the goals are being achieved, anything that threatens those goals becomes the enemy, and there's no experience whatsoever of actual joy. So it's kind of like the mind's cheap copy of living as and in the presence of love. So the invitation as it relates to this work, and you know, what struck me as I watched all the inventiveness of these machines that were just amazing technology, amazing ingenuity, was to realize there was a man 2,000 years ago who had a piece of technology that didn't just bring people to happiness, it restored the experience of direct joy that we're designed to live in, and that doesn't require the use of dopamine. It's aligning with and living within our natural state. And it starts with, you know, the first step in it, when they said to Yeshua 2,000 years ago. And when you realize, you know, the thing that clicked for me as I was watching these genius inventions was a genius of a mind that knew how to restore people to joy, and how that technology has just been thrown by the side. And yet it's 1,000 times more valuable than all the wonderful technology gadgets and stuff you could possibly put your hands on, because it's the only thing that produces a permanent state of the active presence of love. And if we become addicted to stuff, then the importance of forgiveness in the culture, and stuff could include something like the bully that wins over somebody else and therefore gets their dopamine hit, that could be considered stuff, and how forgiveness removes those conditions to the presence of joy, because joy is overridden. Joy is a subtle energy, but when the noise of gotta have stuff, the mind screaming for its stuff, demanding, 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 and there's never enough, need another, 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 and another. So just inviting everybody to take a look at that in the context of doing this work, and in the context of bringing this work forward and assisting people to build the brain cells to understand the importance of taking at least some percentage of your time and dedicating it to restoring your mind to the point where that state of joy becomes your natural state. And then along with that, you'll develop a faculty called choice that literally allows you to bring it. It isn't a matter of something from the past. I have a goal from the past, and I want more of that, so I set goals and I'm pursuing that. But it removes all of those conditions and just leaves people in the state where they naturally know who they are as love, and they naturally experience the presence of that active love in which they live, move, and have their being. And once you've got that, it's hard to get the mind off track. And if your mind goes off track, then that's the next piece of work to do. That's the next piece of forgiveness work that needs to be done. Forgiveness being the removal of what never belonged within this human energy system. The removal, quite literally, of all the goals for this stuff. It doesn't mean don't have stuff. It means that if you have to do something that brings you into a state of pain in order to get your stuff, then your stuff ultimately is going to bring you to pain. And so we're looking to restore an understanding. The other day, Bob gave us a really powerful definition or a statement from Charlie Chaplin. And his Charlie Chaplin said, "You only need power to do harm. Love is enough to do what matters." And most people are out there pursuing power because power allows them to achieve goals. Love brings us to the state of joy, the ultimate reward of a lifetime. There's a story I recount the story in my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again, about the old man on his deathbed. And the child approaches him and says, "Gee, Grandpa, how did you get to live such a joyful life?" And the grandpa says, "Well, for years and years, I chased what people told me would make me happy. Then I decided that go and just be connected, just be in that state of joy, of connectedness. And from there, there are few actual needs, as our culture would profess needs or push us towards needs. And what becomes more important is the expression of who we are as love and bringing that forward to the world, bringing it forward in service to the world. So it seemed like some thoughts worth expressing that might give a little different slant on the whole process of forgiveness. And again, recognizing that the word forgive means remove. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. It really is going back and removing those goals that set up behaviors that don't serve joy, though if we achieve them, bring happiness, or, you know, which is the cheap copy of joy. And of course, the ongoing, you know, when people first start this work, I usually suggest they do 5 words each day for 40 days. And what happens when you step into the forgiveness worksheet process is you get to contact, you get to go into your own unconscious dynamics. And if you spend 40 days in your own unconscious dynamics, if you spend your 40 days in the desert in the ancient scriptures is just a code word for the unconscious. If you spend your 40 days in the desert, it's going to change your life forever. So that's our invitation. We invite you to join us, and you can do that process in one of several ways. You can go to our website, whyagain.org. And you can step into and do the forgiveness process right there on the website. You can download the forgiveness worksheet, print it off on your own printer, or take it to the printer and get it bound and printed, and do worksheets in the comfort of your own home. And or you can go to your app store on your phone and download the world's only forgiveness app. And you do that by simply going to your app store, whether you've got an iPhone or an Android, and you type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, second word, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. You're looking at the world's only forgiveness app. Download it, and right there on your phone, you're carrying out your forgiveness work. So lots of ways to access the tools, and of course, the reason for this show is to support you in understanding the process and carrying forward with the process. And if you have any questions about it, if you're on a station where we can't see you, one of the syndicated stations that carries this show, then if you dial the number 563-999-3581, 563-999-3581, if you dial that number, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And then if you have a question or thought, you push 1, raise his hand in the phone queue, and we'll be having a conversation. And I would love to have a conversation with you. So, Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do have a hand up. And
well, great. Let's say hello.
Area code 541, you're on the air.
Hello, 541.
Hello. I was trying to get out of the buttons, and I couldn't. Okay. I'm really glad that you're making the distinction between happy. Oh, this is Celinda, by the way, in case you didn't recognize
me. We got your voice, young lady. And thank
know,
you. Arya was here today and loved her plate. She had her breakfast on that little plate that you sent her this morning.
Oh, you're kidding. How funny. Yeah, how sweet.
Yeah.
Okay. I was so grateful that you mentioned the distinction between happiness and joy. And so, of course,
how did
I
that strike you? What did that mean for you?
I have reflected on that difference, and I really enjoy you putting that one change in Teilhard de Chardin, Hart Chardin, or how do you say his name?
Yeah, Teilhard de Chardin.
Because I've always loved de Chardin. Okay.
Yeah.
I've always loved that quote, so I've got that written down. And ever since you mentioned the Lenin quote about you just change the meaning of words to destroy a culture, I have really been paying attention, and I've been going to the dictionary a lot, Webster's Dictionary, and I've been going to the derivation of the words in the original languages, and also I've been noticing and really paying attention to the obsolete meanings of words.
Right.
And so I ran to look up happy, and happy is favored by luck or fortune, fortunate. And happiness is good fortune and prosperity, a pleasurable
achieving goals.
Yep, exactly. And also, joy has really come up more in my life again. And I'm realizing how much happenstance is circumstantial. Happiness is circumstantial. It's like happenstance. Oh, if you're lucky and this situation happens, then you're happy. So you can never
get
there.
If you achieve this goal.
Yeah. You can never get there because it's like the carrot in front of the donkey. And I have been also...
Well, actually, my offering would be you can get there. It's just that once the dopamine hit you get, which is quote-unquote your happiness, once that dopamine's been used up, then it takes another hit and another hit and another hit and another hit. And if we don't have joy to fall back on, if we don't have a substitute, it's not long before that whole system in the brain is overloaded and it crashes.
What was it that you called happy powder? Powder or power?
Happy powder. It's been referred to in the brain as happy powder. It's dopamine, a chemical called dopamine, that when you get it, when you achieve a goal, you get a shot of that, and that's the euphoria, the happiness that people feel.
Yeah, I thought maybe that was a name for heroin among users or something. I didn't know.
Well, when someone uses a drug, here's why people get into burnout, if you didn't catch that. When somebody uses drugs like that, it causes the body to burn its dopamine. So the high that comes as a result of an excessive use of dopamine, but then the dopamine gets worn out. It gets used and there's none left, or there's very little left, and that's why somebody needs more of a drug to force the burning of more dopamine, which uses more of the resource until the system just collapses and people, it doesn't matter how much you give them, it's just going to kill them.
Right. Right. They just have total adrenal burnout and whatever else comes down the pike. Yeah. Also, Charlie Chaplin's quote, can you put that in the notes for today? That was really a good quote. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think it went in the notes on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday that Bob had called in and shared that with us. Bob from Australia, remember, he called in and shared that quote with us.
Right. Oh, that's good, Wednesday or Thursday, because I wasn't able to listen that day. Perfect. I'll go back and look. And I've also come to really distinguish that, for me, in this moment of time, the meaning or the understanding that power always involves empowerment. It's always like a shared process. I just really appreciate that. And I'm looking more and more at the significance of true community, whatever true means, you know, our understanding in the moment, of community and cooperation and coordination and co-creativity and all of those, what that has revealed for me.
Well, as you said the word community, I heard it slightly differently than I've ever heard it before, and break it up into community.
Yeah,
when we
community.
Experience our connectedness, that's where that active presence of love becomes strengthened, and
exactly.
People more easily access that state. But the quote, just so you've got it, because it's just a few words from Charlie Chaplin, is, you only need power
to do harm. And the
love is enough. Love is enough to do what matters.
I love it. You know, all of this geographical cure processes that we humans get into, or non-humans, whichever it is, there was some sort of quote from an Eastern sage of long time ago, and I don't know if it's a Taoist quote or a Zen quote or once or something, but something about the quote was something like, I do not need to go out of my house to experience the whole world. It was a quote like that, and if I could find it, I would share it. So our running
the source
off,
of joy is within us.
That's right. And
running off has to do with achieving goals.
Right. Right. And I'm just now beginning to make these connections, you know, to understand, because it's another thing I've been aware of, Michael and Jeannie, is that understanding is a whole different game than wax. I mean, a ball of wax than knowledge. And when I found out that the Aramaic Amen, one of the possible definitions for it, because it was used at the end of contracts and in any end of an agreement conversation, was, this is the ground upon which I stand, or this is the ground of my understanding. And now I'm really enjoying looking at the two of those, the knowledge, which I perceive at this moment in time, is from the analytical brain, and the understanding, which comes from our deeper subconscious connection to the divine as we open up. So I just wanted to share that with you because...
Yeah, one would be information, the other would be connection.
Right, exactly.
And
dopamine... Right? It's experience.
Yeah.
And dopamine...
The other brain chemical that in order for people to experience fulfillment instead of happiness is serotonin. And serotonin comes from connecting. That's when the brain, when we, as opposed to achieving a goal, when we connect with another person, that's when the brain starts to amp its output of serotonin. So it's the connection energy, and that's what brings satisfaction, opposed to the dopamine stimulator, which is satiation. Oh, I got to have more money, more power, more sex, more. And that's the dopamine, more goals, and achieving connection stimulates serotonin release.
What is oxytocin?
Oxytocin. Not oxycontin, but oxytocin. Oxytocin is another, it's a connection chemical. It comes from making connection with another being, whether it's petting your cat or connecting with another person. You know, a mother and a child, there's a bonding chemical when they touch, when skin goes to skin, which so often in clinical settings is not allowed. But that skin to skin creates this powerful burst of oxytocin that is the bonding chemical and healing.
And what would be the equivalent chemical for contentment?
I think contentment would fit with the serotonin release.
Okay. And nourishment would be... I'm making connections here. That's why I'm asking you these questions. Because I realize that, for me, a little metaphor that I've created for stomach is a little triad. The stomach meridian is a little triad of nourishment, contentment, and satisfaction, which I am seeing as meaning, satisfaction as meaning enough.
Fulfillment. Yeah, you look at that song that the kids were singing back a few decades ago, I can't get no satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pursuing goals, and there's no satisfaction in that. There's only satiation. That's why the person who gets a million says, well, when I get a million, then I'll be happy. Well, no, I'm happy, but now that my dopamine's used up, I need another million and another million. People wonder why, you know, how much can you accumulate? How much can you possibly use? It's got nothing to do with how much you can use. It's got to do with internal chemistry, which is mind energy.
Would one think of as a neurochemical that would, or a hormone or whatever these are, in relation to satisfaction of having enough? Contentment, would that be the same?
I think you'd be back to serotonin.
Slightly different.
The connection, sure. Fulfillment.
Satisfaction. Yeah. Okay. Well, satiation would also fit, wouldn't it? Because the baby, think of the baby nursing. When it's had enough milk, it's satiated. So.
Well, I think that would really be the misuse of the word, satiation. I think when the child's had enough milk, they're full, they're satisfied. Satiation is the to me would be the pursuit. I need more. I need more. So satiation becomes a substitute for satisfaction.
I hope you don't mind me picking these into tiny pieces, but
no,
it really helped me synthesize.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. It's a good conversation.
If I have to always move, if I have to always be somewhere else, if I have to always keep myself safe, I'm basically depending on dopamine hits.
Yes.
Ah, very interesting.
And protection takes us out of fulfillment, out of creative mode.
A need to protect or a need to be safe. Okay.
Well, just having the mind and body in protect mode, you know, if there's threat,
right.
If there's danger, you know,
right.
No society or no person does what it takes to produce a full life if they're in protection mode.
Exactly.
You know, when the city's running and, you know, all is well, you know, the delivery vehicles move and the, you know, the grocery store is open and the gardener's in the garden gardening and the neighbors are saying hello to the neighbors and they're gathering and playing or creating or healing or whatever it is they're doing. But the minute the alarm goes in that there's a threat to survival, then protection mode happens, you know, in that protection mode, you know, the garbage men don't go out and collect garbage. If there's a threat in the city, the garbage men don't go out and collect garbage and the garbage accumulates. If there's a threat, you know, the delivery vehicle doesn't bring food into the city, there's a threat. You know, everything tends to go into shutdown emergency mode, which is okay in the short term. But when one steps away from creative mode into protect mode, they're in trouble as a society and as a body.
Perfect. And at the same time, what I'm realizing about my lack of depth awareness and why I have the need in this moment for that lack of depth awareness, because my goal is targeted out there. I have to have someone or something fulfill that or give that to me, whatever that is, which we talked about, space and freedom and things like that, and time. What I'm realizing is that I was given all that neediness, or that need that I see as neediness. I have been given all my needs at creation, that I'm running around looking out there for what I already have inside of me. It reminds me of the prince who thinks he's or she, the princess prince who thinks he or she is a pauper. It's a pretty amazing
functions out of a pauper's brain, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'm just looking at satiate in the dictionary, to provide someone with more than enough, a glut.
Perfect. I hadn't thought to look that word up. Thank you. And you're not going to find it Googling it, Michael, very rarely, the origin of the words, which is so important
right.
for my
yeah.
understanding. And the
yeah, the ancient use is glut. It's more than enough.
That's such good.
And it's become, you know, so many words have had their meanings changed, and that's why we can't reason correctly about so many things, because we don't have the correct definitions of words. Plato once said, let me define the words and I will end the argument.
Let me define the words and I will end the argument, right?
Well, I think I don't think that was a self-centered, I'll make up definitions. He was saying, if we come up with the definition of the word, then there's nothing to argue about. If one person over here is doing one and one's doing another, they're not in a definition. They're in errant definitions. And again, take that back to Vladimir Lenin, and here's a guy who's responsible probably for more deaths on planet Earth than any human being in history, and he says, change the meaning of a culture's words and you can destroy a culture, because you can put people at war with each other.
And what the definition is it's a consensus. And if everybody is in consensus, it doesn't matter whether they're in illusionary consensus or if they are in true consensus and in harmony with each other, it's still a consensual definition. Is a consensual process, a collective process, other than when it's the individual, you know, saying this is my definition. And that's not even a problem either, Michael. If I can say, this is my definition, this is my understanding at the moment, this is my life experience, and then saying as compared to saying it as this is the way it is, this is true.
And the beauty of having, the beauty of having the Aramaic available is now we've got a language that's based in the physics of the world. It's not based in men's minds as every other language is.
And this is an additional perception I have, or insight, I'm not sure which. The Middle Eastern languages are very fluid. Very often they have more than one possible meaning for a word, just like we do in English. But more so, there's more of a sense of open-endedness when I'm studying the Aramaic and, you know, the Lord's Prayer, for example, or the Beatitudes. And by the way, why is the Eighth Beatitude kind of left out in most of the Aramaic teaching?
Well, they're not. I created a poster that, you know, from my work with it, and my focus was on with what are the Aramaic words that take us to the state of being, where it then splits off in a different direction in the Eighth Beatitude.
And that,
so
and
that poster,
right.
That was a choice that I made.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because Neil Douglas Klotz must have made the same choice, because on his teaching on the Beatitudes, he does the same thing, Michael. That's very fascinating.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that. I haven't looked at his stuff.
I'm learning the Lord's Prayer. I'm learning how to chant it in Aramaic, and I'm using Neil Douglas Klotz's things, like I mentioned to you. I'm a little more than halfway through now, and then after that I want to be able to chant the, if I can, the Beatitudes, even if I have to make up my own little chants with them. And I am just so pleased, so joyful when I do that. And so, and as I've said many times when I've talked to you and Jeannie and even Dr. Tim, just having all of these different perspectives is like my little kaleidoscope, my little mental, emotional kaleidoscope is just popping with all these little turns and twists. I love it. It's like
cool.
An opening process for me. You know, it opens me. Having all these different perspectives opens me, because I want to close down. You know, I want to be right. I want to blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I'm just really grateful for every one of you. And just, it's such a blessing having stumbled on this way.
Delighted and honored to be on the team.
I know, and I am so honored. And it's for the first time in my life, I don't feel this desperate need to seek. I just, it's unfolding as it's unfolding. And it's very, very, it's very, very
sounds like, yeah, well, what I hear you saying is your compulsion to achieve goals has been alleviated. and you're in satisfaction rather than pursuit,
yeah,
achieving goals. And, oh, if I just had this, then if only I could, if, and that's all goal-based. And what I hear you saying is,
yeah,
oh, okay,
and
so now I've let go of that.
I'm heading towards contentment. I'm working with satisfaction, and I'm heading towards contentment, and then joy is beckoning.
Cool. I'm just getting ready. Can you hear a sound in the background right now?
Not really.
No? Good. Okay. Because I just hit a button that started a piece of music on my phone, and I'm sending you a text. There's a program out there called Spotify, and they have a really beautiful rendition called Abwun of the Aramaic instruction set.
Sweet. Well, thank you and Jeannie so much. And an Easter card is coming your way, because like Christmas and New Year's and Thanksgiving, Easter I experience all year round. So it's all the timeless zone.
Cool. The link that I'm sending you is, and I'll send it to you too, Jeannie, so that that you can just put it in the notes if somebody else wants it. But it's on a program called Spotify, which we have a subscription to. You can buy, but you don't need to buy it in order to listen to their music. They do, you know, disperse commercials and that sort of thing in between it. But it'll give you a taste of it. It's pretty powerful, pretty sweet.
Sweet.
Should be in your inbox.
All right. And it just popped up. Thank you.
There you go. Enjoy.
And I know one other thing. We were talking about protection, and it's kind of a lockdown place. And I have always been very much inspired by angels, especially guardian angels. And I'm going back to a very, very early sense of myself and the sense of safety and the times when I was safe, the focus on the times when I was safe. And always there were like pictures of guardian angels guiding the little children, you know, that my grandmother would have on the wall. This is part of this whole depth awareness worksheet and the mind shifters and stuff that I'm playing with.
Right.
And it is the sense of I've been protected since I was born. I was just telling yesterday, I'd have been dead probably 200 times already if it hadn't been for protection. That divine.
Sweet.
Protection. Yeah. And
Jeannie has a sweet story about her son that ties in with that. Jeannie, you want to share that? About Ryan?
Okay. Say it again.
About Ryan when he was small with the picture of the guardian angel?
Oh, yeah. It's the picture where the two children are walking across a bridge that's kind of dilapidated and there's an angel like over them. And I had that, it was my picture when I was a child, and I had it reframed and had it hanging in Ryan's room. And he would get up every night. I mean, I think he was probably five before he ever slept through the night. He'd come running into the room, and, of course, it woke me up as soon as I heard his feet hit the floor. And I'd walk him back in his room and cover him up and, you know, tell him he was safe and to go back to sleep. And this one night I said, look at that picture. I said, see the guardian angel watching over the children? I said, there's angels watching over you too. And he says, yeah, but Mommy, I want somebody with skin on them.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Do you know?
Isn't that great?
That when I feel unsafe, very often the prayer I will say is five little angels around my bed.
Mm,
are you familiar
sweet
with that one?
No, I haven't heard that one.
5 little angels around my bed, one at the foot and one at the head, one to sing and one to pray and one to keep my soul till day.
Hadn't heard that before. That's sweet. Well, it's interesting, the transformation. Yeah, the transformation in one generation where Jeannie, you know, her experience with Ryan doing that, and Arya has no, not even the second thought about putting her head down in the dark and going to sleep. It's just, she's safe and she knows it. You know, she's got a different energy experience.
You know, so, it's interesting the difference between, yes, go ahead.
Well, she's got a dad that's holding that space for her. And I think that's primary. And unfortunately, Ryan's dad back then was kind of in a hostile place, and so it wasn't such a safe space.
Do you know what's interesting about one of the differences between Eastern perceptions and Western perceptions between with light and dark? That the
Eastern perception
does not conceive of dark as being evil. It's just the opposite of light. Yin yang.
The absence of light.
Yeah, the opposite.
Yeah, I would.
The absence
yeah.
of light.
Yeah, I would make it the absence, not the opposite. If we start to treat, and a lot of people do this, treat darkness. In fact, I had a conversation recently with someone about, you know, they're saying, well, you can't experience light without the experience of darkness. In other words, you know, to really take in your joy, you've got to have had pain. It's like, no, that's a false equivalency. That's an improperly used metaphor when you use the word darkness to describe a positive presence, which it is not. Darkness is simply an absence. We make the mistake of making
right.
it a positive presence, then there's something to be afraid of, where when it's just an absence, it's like the example I use is nobody has ever created a flash dark. You know, a little device that you push the button on it and all the light goes out because the darkness puts the light out. No, there's a flash light, and because darkness is an absence, light fills the room. That's why that scriptural statement of, you know, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness, because the darkness is an absence. It's not a positive presence. Positive meaning an existent presence. It's an absence.
Okay.
Just like
good.
Fear. Fear is not a fear is not a positive presence. It's simply an absence of love. And when active present love comes into the space, in the same way as when light goes on with a flashlight, the darkness dissipates because there's nothing to it. There's no power in it.
I'll share with you a poem that was written in Siberia right after the collapse of the Soviet Union called In the Presence of the Light. Have you ever seen that poem?
No.
I'll send it to you.
Please share it.
All right. Thank you.
Cool.
And thank you. I am complete.
All right, young lady. Well, you have a blessed one. Appreciate you. Thanks for your thinking mind participating in our development.
Yes. It's exciting, isn't it?
It is. The original incredible joining.
There you go.
Awesome. And we have another caller. And
all right.
Area
say hello.
808, you're on the air. Ms. Roma?
Good morning.
Aloha.
Good morning.
Good morning, young lady.
I had a resurrection yesterday on Easter. Oh,
all right.
It was absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. And by the way,
tell us what happened.
Let me just preface that the conversation that was just that you were just talking about darkness. From my last guru I worked with, I really got that. What it is infinite possibility, undefined infinite possibility. And
that's an interesting way to think of it. It's a space in which anything can happen, right? Yeah.
Exactly, from which everything comes out of, yeah. So that's how darkness is for me. So, oh my gosh. Well, at like 6 o'clock in the morning yesterday on Easter morning, I really wanted to experience an Easter service with some. I went to Agape and couldn't get in. You know, my mind is working so strangely nowadays that I don't even understand how to navigate the internet so much anymore. It's, you know, I get lost. So anyway, and then I thought about the Unity Church here in Maui, which I had been a board member of, and I've been involved in, you know, back in the 1980s. I discovered Unity in New York City with Eric Butterworth in the 70s. So, and I was raised an agnostic. Right. So, you know, I came into adulthood with complete clean slate and was blessed to have Eric Butterworth there, who wrote a book called Discover the Power Within You. Maybe some of you know. But anyway, so I was just searching and searching all morning long on Easter. There was nothing going on with the Baha'is. I often hang out with the Baha'is, you know, which is an extension of them. It's an evolution. It's a spiritual evolution of out of the Muslim tradition. But it's global and, you know, it's really nice. Baha'i is really beautiful.
And it's Aramaic. Baha'u'llah spoke Aramaic.
Yeah, right.
It's one of the major faiths on the planet that came out of the Aramaic language.
I love it. Yeah. Well, they're often there on Sunday morning on the internet, and they weren't. So anyway, I can't remember all the details, but I finally just decided to go out. I finally, at 11 o'clock yesterday, the Unity Church of Maui, it was 12:30 it came up. At 12:30 onto my internet, it just popped up, and I got to watch the last, like, 10 minutes. The sermon was all over, but the energy field was so strong, and I just absorbed it. And it just came into me. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to go for a walk. So I went for a walk, and I was walking around wishing everybody a happy Easter. And it was me. I was wishing myself a happy Easter. And then later on in the day, I just felt this incredible, amazing happiness just pouring through me. And I thought, my gosh, that's the power of my word. I have manifested this. So I don't know. I can't remember the details. I woke up, you know, in that semi-state between asleep and awake. You know, that
right.
There's like the semi-state between being asleep and awake, you know. Huh?
What? Yep. In a space of guidance?
Yeah. Yeah. You're completely still. It's possible in that state between awake and Einstein used to go there. When he had a problem he couldn't figure out, he would put in, you told this story, don't you? Isn't this a story that you tell?
Well, actually,
that Einstein,
was Edison,
if he had a problem
ball.
He couldn't figure out. Yeah, he would put an iron ball in his hand and lie down to go to sleep. And as soon as he would actually reach that intermediate state and start falling asleep, the ball would fall out, and he would find himself awakened in that intermediate stage between sleep and awake, where you can actually draw from the infinite anything,
yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was actually Thomas Edison that did that with the iron ball.
Oh, I thought that was Einstein.
That I told
that was
throughout.
Thomas Edison.
No, it was that Edison. Yeah, that was his way.
Oh,
connected.
Wow.
Sweet. Well, glad you're in that connected state and supporting you and holding it. We're down to the last minute or so. So I'm going to just say thank you to everybody for joining us, and we hold the space for this Easter season to infill and bring that presence of joy totally, completely to every cell in your structure and extend it out to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio.
with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.